And we have the honor of having Dr. Carolyn Chung speaking here, and she is coming from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, where she is the Vice President, Chief Data and Analytics Officer, Co-Director, Institute for Data Science and Oncology Professor, Radiation Oncology and Diagnostic Imaging, again, at that institute. So if we could welcome her. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for having me. Great to have you all in the room. And this is just a last-minute replacement, I think. So I'm glad it all worked out. So I know that I think there was a different topic, but we're going to talk about oncology. And I have to confess that I was told about this talk not too long ago, so this is somewhat of a recycled talk, but I think the points are going to be salient here. I wanted to talk about AI, quantitative imaging, and how it applies to cancer, and really thinking about context of the data at the point of training and developing a model all the way through to actually implementing and delivery. And some of the observations we've seen, some of the challenges that I think I foresee in terms of why such, although there's a huge amount of effort developing AI models in oncology, as you can see, why such small proportions of those models are actually successfully getting translated and adopted in clinical care. So as far as imaging is concerned in modern cancer care, I would say that imaging is a beacon of modern cancer care. You know, historically, we would actually see the patient, examine the patient. I remember using calipers to measure the tumor size at one point in time, you know, way back when. And now we really wouldn't necessarily make any hard decisions until we had certain imaging measures of response, non-response, the size and staging does rely on that imaging measure. And so I've kind of taken it as the weather vane being the exam you do in the room. You know what's happening to the patient right at that moment in time. You can take clinical trials and do meta-analyses, and I liken that to the farmer's almanac when it comes to weather versus evidence in medicine. But what we really want to do, because I think the farmer's almanac has very good purpose, and it is actually very good at predicting big, regular weather patterns. And similarly, meta-analyses and clinical trials collectively can give us really good signal of when there's a big signal that something is or isn't going to work for a group of patients or a population of patients. But ultimately, when we're sitting in the clinic, we actually want to know what to do with that one person and what decision we're going to make with that patient in front of us. And it's sort of like this weather map that you're getting all of this data that's flowing in, whether it be imaging data, genomic data, the clinical data, and you want to synthesize it in a way that you can actually anticipate what's going to happen to this patient and make the best informed decision, maximizing that therapeutic ratio. And it really comes down to what is it the problem that you're trying to solve, and what will actually inform that in a timely fashion with confidence, knowing that the data that you're collecting has certain levels of uncertainty, the models that you're going to develop are also going to have a certain level of uncertainty. So how do you weigh out how confident you are in using the outputs of these models when you make that clinical decision? And it should be based on how uncertain are you at the start. So if you have no clue what you would do and you're saying, well, it's a toss-up, perhaps getting additional information could sway you in one direction. If you're 90% confident of what you're going to do, if that model comes in and disagrees with you, I think that a lot of people would be hard-pressed to say they would change their mind because this model is predicting. You'd probably say there's something not quite right, and you may go back and look at why the model is suggesting something different when it comes to decision support. So I think just kind of thinking through that concept is something that we've actually worked on with our data scientists. One of the things that we do in the Institute for Data Science and Oncology is that we don't want to just be a data science institute that's just developing models, publishing. We want to develop these models that we can actually translate and bring into clinic. And that creates a robust discussion between the data scientists and the clinicians to say, what problem are you actually trying to solve? Please stop making widgets that nobody really cares about, right? So trying to solve real problems, but also saying with what confidence do you need? In the last nephrology session, you know, there was a discussion around how the models are not quite ready for prime time. Well, the question is, what performance or what metric would convince you to say you would actually replace a biopsy with the prediction of this model? What would that take? And I think there's a lot of companies out there that are asking that same question. What clinical trial would we design, or what output would we actually demand after which we say, we are confident we're going to switch and make the decision-making around the output? Now, when it comes to imaging, although I said imaging is a beacon, if we're really honest with what we're doing in cancer, we're still looking at patterns of what's changing on the screen. We're seeing if the tumor is growing or shrinking. We're seeing if the metabolic activity is going up or down. But we really don't have a lot of depth or breadth of knowledge around what, if we see an imaging change, what does that actually mean pathologically, biologically, underneath? And so one of the things that we are pursuing is getting more spatial registration of the imaging and pathology data so that we can actually better understand when you see a specific change, this is what it's representing biologically. And the only way we can do that is by actually making the imaging measurements more quantitative and more precise. Because if we say the reason why we're stuck with response measures that are quite crude is because there's a lot of variability in the imaging. So here's an example in terms of defining a responder versus non-responder. At this point in time, it's still a lot of qualitative descriptions, and you see lots of qualitative words of suspicious with, or consistent with, or suggestive of, and it's not necessarily so definitive of whether someone's responding or not. And even in clinical trials, when we actually try to get to the semi-quantitative assessment of categorizing whether someone's responding or not, there's a lot of variability in that measurement. The reason why the reason why we're stuck there is because the images that are acquired are not consistent across different centers, across different time points, across different scanners. The protocols are different, and the measurements can change widely depending on where the patient is getting scanned and with what protocol. The tumor, and I'll show you some examples, where the tumor can literally appear and disappear just because of the protocol of the imaging that's actually taken. And that could actually really change what endpoint you're actually measuring, whether someone is classified as a responder or a non-responder. And if you're trying to train an AI model and you've classified patients and you've annotated them as responder and non-responder, and we're saying that the technical variability can actually change that output, then you're training the model with a growing amount of uncertainty in your training data set from the very start. The second piece is that even if you got very clean data to train it, when you actually apply it out in the real world, if you're not acquiring the data in the same way as you did in that training data set, you may not be getting the same performance, and what's being predicted may not actually reflect the performance of the model itself. And so our default is we tend to say, oh, the model is not performing as well, we need to retrain. But it may not be the model that's performing poorly. It may be that we're feeding it data that is not actually suitable for that model. Finally, at this point in time, we say the tumor is starting to shrink because we're just looking at patterns, and we say that the patient is responding, and the tumor is growing, and the patient is not responding, they're progressing. But I would argue that not all the tumors grow and shrink in the same way. So the red curve looks a lot like a very aggressive tumor that's very chemo or radiation sensitive, like small cell cancer. And you can get a tumor that actually shrinks down dramatically, very quickly over a short period of time, but then grows back with a vengeance. And so depending on your trial design, if you looked at the patient and you said, at this time point, let's say it's 6 months, you would say that the patients in the red curve are the best responders. But if you actually took the endpoint at this time point over here, all of a sudden you've got a very different categorization of who's actually responded and who's done well. And so one of the things that we have started to look at is, does tumor velocity or the shape of that curve, whether the tumor is, even just looking at volume, versus whether the tumor is in absolute has grown or shrunk, is more important? Because someone who has a tumor that is ever so slightly growing or starts to slow its growth and continues to ever so slightly grow over time, but starts to plateau, this person's survival is likely going to be substantially longer than someone who has that red curve. And so that overall response rate may not be a really good measure of response to a treatment. It may be that even tumors that are growing, if it starts to slow and plateau, may actually prolong survival. And this is one of the pieces that I think that the FDA has swung back to saying overall survival is the endpoint we need to look at in cancer. And one of the pieces that I think we're starting to figure out is that perhaps the way that we've defined response and progression-free survival, this measure of response and what we're considering progression may be the mistake that we've made in terms of not finding the correlation between the progression-free survival and overall survival, because we're often calling these patients who are green progression because the tumor is continuing to grow. But perhaps if we're looking at the trajectory and the volume and the velocity, we may actually say that this patient has actually become stable and is actually responding. So recategorizing what is response. Now, when we look at the quantitative imaging workflow, like I said, the image acquisition is one source. So if you have different vendors, if you have GE, Siemens, whatever vendor you want to choose, and you've got at MD Anderson, we have a mix because we have three of the major vendors, you're going to get some technical differences in the actual measurements themselves just from the devices. You layer on that the protocols themselves could be different. Your slice thickness could be different. People are trying to save time. You might be incorporating AI into the actual acquisition, which actually takes less data in terms of the actual image and actually interpolates what the information should be on the screen. And so when you actually start to layer in all of these pieces, the thing is that the anatomical image that you're visually looking at on the screen may look identical to the human eye, but some of the pieces, those biological signals that we could be measuring off the screen, may be changing because we've never really paid attention to them before. We haven't demanded to the vendors that those numbers need to be identical. And so if we want to go back and say, can we do something, I'm sure you've heard the term radiomics, but if we want to do radiomics properly, we need to go back and look at this from a quantitative perspective. Now, if the images are registered over time and they're not registered anatomically, so using deformable registration, again, there's a lot of AI algorithms that are helping do this, you're going to be looking at different parts of the tissue. And so they're not true registration from a biological standpoint, even if they're from a 3D space perspective, they're overlaid. And so making sense of the actual biology underlying the imaging is actually a piece that we haven't been doing very well, but I think there's definitely an opportunity to do. When it comes to segmentation, at this point in time, a lot of the work is still relying on human annotators. Thousands of images, people are annotating. There's human variability. There's lots of publications that are showing variability and inter-observer variability, as well as the same observer contouring and segmenting in different ways. And this is where AI can come in and at least create a consistent region of interest as we start to extract out these features, because many of the radiomic studies, especially the ones that are leveraging AI now, has shown that the actual region of interest definition is the primary driver of your features. And so you may get completely different radiomic signatures depending on how you've actually defined that region of interest. Now, many of the studies are looking at radiomic features to the omics profiles to the clinical outcomes. And you can imagine we've started to pay a lot of attention from the genomic state around batch effect and technical differences. But we have sort of ignored all of these blue boxes that are leading to the radiomic features that are that we're trying to correlate with the genomic signatures and clinical outcomes. So I'm the co-president for the Quantitative Medical Imaging Coalition. It's an international nonprofit organization, and we've been working across multiple metrology labs as well as professional societies, and we've been, I think this society would be great to bring on. It's not necessarily cancer specific, but looking at how quantitative imaging can actually help AI and how AI can actually help with quantitative imaging for precision medicine at large. I mean, I'm giving oncology as an example, but there are many other circumstances and many other disease states where imaging is a primary endpoint measure that we're actually looking at signal of response, non-response, disease progression, et cetera. Here's just an example of a quantitative imaging workflow and how it actually affects radiomic feature extraction. So if you take this current workflow, so someone gets their image acquired, the raw imaging data is captured, it's reconstructed, there's post-processing, and then you've got the region of interest segmentation. We think that all the patients should be going through this one channel. What can actually happen is this same patient could go to multiple scanners. The image reconstruction might be done differently at different centers. The image post-processing may be done differently, and then you've got ROI segmentation, and all of a sudden this explodes into 1,000 different kinds of images, 1,000 different data sets with a limited number of patients. And we're trying to find features that are consistent, and this is where the reproducibility problem in these studies really start to come out. The patients who are collected up in one center, and that one academic center does all of this imaging chain consistently, and they find a set of features, and they go and take another data set, and they've done it exactly the same way, and they reproduce, and they say they've internally validated those features. They publish the paper. Academic center number two tries to do exactly the same thing. Well, not all of this imaging chain is actually published in enough detail for people to reproduce it exactly. And so if you do it slightly differently, what happens is the radiomic features they're pulling out look very different, and the reproducibility is not there. And so I think that, you know, these are pieces that we need to think about in terms of why are the studies failing? How do we do better moving forward? And there were some examples around benchmarking, some discussion around benchmarking in the last session. I think we do need to start to think about how are we actually going to provide transparency in the methods so that others can actually properly reproduce the findings. But the second piece is also recognizing the heterogeneity and testing the robustness of whatever features you may be publishing to say, we know that it'll work because the signal is big enough. There are certain pieces that will come through even with a lot of noise, and that's what we've been working with in medicine. That's why clinical medicine still works. It's not that we've been unable to make progress in the era of pre-AI, but I think that we're getting even more noise moving forward, and if we don't start recognizing what we're actually looking for, rather than just being bedazzled by the fact that it can create a prediction, we're going to end up running into a lot of cost with very little benefit. There are tools that are being developed, such as non-reference image quality measures. This is one that's up on GitHub, and you can actually run it on all your images and compare your images. We've actually employed this as a quality check for all of our images coming off the scanner. So we actually have all the MR images coming off. We measure the no reference metrics, and if there's suddenly a step function in your quality, so you're humming along at a certain level and suddenly it drops, then we've actually gone back and said, which scanners did that happen in? We actually found a software upgrade had changed something, and our imaging physicists were actually able to step in. So these can be really useful tools in an ongoing fashion as well. Now, the reason why we started to pay attention to image quality in terms of AI training, this is done in collaboration with another lab, in my imaging lab. We actually started to look at image quality and model training, and could it actually influence how quickly you can train a model with fewer data sets, because everyone's just saying more and more data is what you need. I would agree with Andrew Ng that it's smart data that you need. You need enough context and enough detailed, and that you can actually collect what you actually need to train the model. And then, do we know whether the hypothesis was, if you trained it on real, everyone says if the model has not seen that kind of data before, it will not be able to perform on data that it's never seen before. And what is that generalizability? So we actually started to look at, we took one image quality metric, this was CJV, You can pick any one you want, but let's just say we looked at this, and this is more of a conceptual thing to walk you through. We took it from, so a smaller CJV means that the there's increased tissue contrast, so it's better quality images. So you take the training set with the better quality images and you test it on poorer quality images than you started out with. This is sort of what would happen from a, you know, if you take a super highly curated data set and then you throw it into the wild. The other vice versa was to train it in the poor with the poorer quality data set and try testing it on really high quality data. You'd expect that to work because you'd say, well, the high quality data should help the model do better. And then we said, well, let's take it in the middle. And we actually saw that if you go from if you go with the training data set that is ascending, so if you take the high quality and then test it on the poor quality, you actually got better performance than if you did it the other way around, which is interesting because it's counterintuitive to everything that we've been talking about. So I think that, you know, this is not a definitive study. This was one piece, but I think the observation that we've actually looked at to say that this is an observation we've seen tells us that we need to start paying attention to image quality or data quality and how it actually influences the performance of that model. Because one of the things that we found is taking this, we've actually been able to train models with 50, 150 data sets, not thousands, and still get reasonable performance very quickly by taking in very high quality data with high quality consistent annotations. So it's just an interesting observation that I want to share with you. Now, as I said, we want to think about thinking through all the way through to implementation. I talked about data quality. You know, data source is another piece. Can you actually rely on that data? Where did it come from? And this comes back to the model card idea. What sorts of biases are there? And I'll talk about, you know, everyone thinks about bias as demographic differences, but there are other components of bias when it comes to these models that I'm sure you're familiar with, but I don't think people are necessarily accounting for or demanding in their model cards. And finally, data availability. So if you take a data set that's highly curated and every single data point is available for that patient group, how realistic is it that you're going to reproduce those measurements consistently in the real world? So thinking about it through not only from the training and validation data, but actually as you apply it. And people kind of think about these characteristics as garbage in, garbage out. I actually have pivoted away from the garbage in, garbage out statement because I actually think it really depends on how you're trying to use this model. That the data is adequate or good quality and usable if it meets the needs of what you're trying to do. So someone's garbage could be other people's useful data, and most people would say useful data would not be garbage, but you know, you get my drift is that it's not just garbage in, garbage out. It's not a binary thing. I think that it depends on how you're trying to use that data, and you want to think about it throughout the life cycle of that data. So does it actually correctly represent the real world construct that the data describes? So for instance, if you have 10 different parameters that you're trying to feed into that model, can you consistently get that in every patient at every time point? If you cannot, then you need to start testing which of these can you drop out and still run that model, or you're not going to have a clinically robust generalizable model. So we've started to think about how do we drop out parameters and think about the reductive model being the bare minimum. And then thinking about if you had all of it, if you fed it up in everything, does it actually improve performance? So we've actually started to look at that gradient of what is the benefit of adding those additional tests. The recent publication around the large language model that was based on the UK data set, that they actually showed that, for instance, predicting diabetes when they used that large, the UK data set prediction was not as good using the large language model than just tracking A1C. A1C is very cheap, everyone can get it, it's you know, physicians know how to interpret it, so would you run that through and burn through carbon footprint to get your prediction if you can actually get it, if you're worried about diabetes in your population? So thinking about where you're actually going to use this tool is something to consider. So as I said, most people think about bias in terms of the context of cohort selection, race, ethnicity, geographic location, et cetera. I would say that we do need to start to think about the availability of data, especially as people think about serial tracking of patients and looking at decision point after decision point, as well as measurement error bias. So all of the technical variability in the actual measurements themselves. And thinking through all of that is capturing that metadata, both from the training, the validation, and implementation phase. And this is where we really start to talk about what needs to go into the model card, that someone who's looking at the model to consider using it would actually understand enough to know that they can actually apply it. So here's just an example of mismatch of training validation versus implementation. So training validation, I'm sure you've seen many of these computer vision models. They're always examples of very pristine lungs with one lung nodule. You know, you can obviously isolate those out. And even then, trying to define the margins of the tumor are, I think there would be disagreement if I gave you red pens around the room to try to get this done. Having said that, we can all point out where the tumors are. But once the model is FDA approved, what's happening is that these models are getting thrown out into the wild, and people are using it in patients like this on the right. And I'm pretty sure if you kind of take a step back and I ask you, do you think that this model that was trained on the data on the left would work on the right, or if it would probably really struggle, I think most of you would agree that it probably won't work so well on the right side. But that's what's happening. And I think this is where we really need to start to talk with our colleagues and work with our colleagues. And as you're making decisions about what you're going to turn on or off, you need to test the breadth of what you're probably going to see in your patient population and see whether this model, it could surprise us, it could work perfectly well. I'm skeptical, but I think that being able to test the breadth of where you're planning to apply it, and vice versa, what we've had is conversations with the FDA and, you know, other bodies around whether we should be creating it, whether we really should be treating it like a device versus more that drug model of this model works within this patient population and in this application, this intended use. Just like we would say a drug is approved for this intended use, and you're allowed to use it off-label, but you're using it off-label and you need to acknowledge that. And so you could run it on here just to say, can I get some extra information? But this model was not designed. If all the training and validation data look like the patients on the left, this was not designed to deal with the case on the right. Now, there is a large impact. There is a large variability of data out there. And so I work with the NCTN network, and with the IROC lab, we actually collected up a brain MRI images from multiple landmark phase 3 trials across the brain metastasis scope. And so we actually looked at just the imaging characteristics. We didn't look at the endpoints of the study. We didn't affect the endpoints of the study. We just wanted to look at how consistent are images, even in the clinical trial setting. And the ranges of just slice thickness alone went from 0.9 millimeters up to 5 millimeters. And so imagine looking for a 1 millimeter brain metastasis in a 5 millimeter slice thickness MRI. It's like fishing around for raisins in raisin bread that's been chopped in inches, right? So you're not going to see the raisin at all. And so we actually did a study with my postdoc here where we actually reconstructed an image, an MR that was done at 1 millimeter, and started to reconstruct at thicker images. We didn't get to 5 millimeters. We didn't have to. You can see the tumor at the end of the red arrow in the bottom box here. And you can see that at 2 millimeters, if you came up really close and squinted with the eye of faith knowing that it's there, you can see a slight hint that it's kind of there. Even knowing that it's there, it's just not visible on the 3 millimeter scan. And so imagine if the patient's going from one center to another or one scanner to another that may not have consistent protocols, you're going to see this tumor appearing and disappearing. If it suddenly appears, do they get enrolled on a trial? And then suddenly it disappears, you're like, yay, it's a response, or vice versa. Someone didn't have it, and then it suddenly appears, and now they're taken off a systemic trial because they've got progressive brain metastases. So this is just an example that's not even AI that shows what the implications are for the therapy for that patient and how we're interpreting our clinical trials. But let alone that the MRI, the AI is not going to detect something that is just not there. The signal's not there because the images were acquired in a certain way, and you're feeding in data that is not consistent. In terms of the context and thinking about metadata, I'm sure you've talked about this before, but in the MIT study, this actually was a good reminder for the imaging scientists, and I include this for the imaging scientists, is that lots and thousands of images from COVID were actually uploaded into the cloud, and everyone collaborated. The world's largest, the smartest data scientists were coming together to saying, we can help diagnose COVID using AI. And I'm sure you remember all of this. And hundreds of models were actually developed in this challenge. And they, even the winning models, when they actually threw them out into the wild, into emergency rooms, they started failing. And then MIT went back and restudied what happened in this challenge. And what happened is that everyone didn't pay attention. The metadata was available, but people did not pay attention to the age of the patient. Metadata, age of the patient. They just went straight to the data, they went straight to the images and started throwing it into their model architectures. You pick your favorite model architecture, computer vision model. They just started throwing the data in without paying attention to the fact that the pediatric patients were largely COVID negative because this was early in the pandemic, and it wasn't until the later strains that the kids started getting sick. The adult patients were sick, and so what happened is these models started learning the difference between a pediatric and adult lung rather than COVID versus no COVID. So when you throw it out into the emergency room and you've got adult after adult coming in, they're all being tested positive by the AI because they're adult lungs, and that's what the model had learned to differentiate. So just an example of not paying attention to the metadata when you're actually selecting your training and validation data sets is a critical piece. So in terms of the image, quantitative imaging and how to revolutionize AI, I had the privilege of writing this paper with the Federation of American Scientists. This actually was a day one proposal that hit the new administration. You can see it was published in December, so we didn't know who the new administration was at the time. But we've had ongoing, there's ongoing discussions around multiple organizations being interested in this, around thinking about how do we actually do better than what I've been describing of what the reality is. That how do we move from looking at pictures, describing images as pictures, and really moving to that quantitative space? Because there's a huge wealth of information in there, but for us to track differences and changes over time, especially leveraging machines and leveraging AI technology, we need to be more consistent, and we need to be able to be explicit in the variability in how we're actually collecting that data. At the same time, it's not only going to help the AI side, it will actually improve clinical care, because what happens is if someone comes in to my clinic and they've got a 5 millimeter slice thickness MRI from some center, some imaging center, and I'm looking at them going, you have a 2 millimeter brain metastasis, I need to scan you again. So now this patient is getting two scans instead of one. And if we could just all do it a certain way, saying, what is that bare minimum? And here is the higher bar, but stay within that range, we would actually reduce the amount of images that are even required. So that would save patients, it would save patients time, it would save the system time. It would actually help us gather more quantitative data sets to train models moving forward. And it, as I showed in terms of measuring that image quality as we're training, we may not need as many data points as we think we do. And then when we're actually rolling this out, we know that there's a certain threshold of image quality in which the models will perform, and we'll be collecting and using data within that range. And so the next step was really to start to discuss establishing centers of excellence for quantitative imaging, educating stakeholders, so it's a privilege for me to be here to talk to you about this challenge, accrediting programs for vendors, and this is something that the vendors are actually interested in, as well as moving towards reimbursement codes for following the quantitative imaging metrology. And ACR has done a good job from an imaging standpoint to try to, you know, at least raise the bar in how you actually even evaluate AI within the workflows. This, the whole idea of data and context from the point of model training to validation to implementation was so important that we actually wrote this paper in Cancer Research. And this is ultimately the foundational principles that we actually followed, that I've followed as we've designed out our data management system. We consider all observations in context, meaning that we need to collect the context, we need to collect that metadata. And the thing is that when you actually talk with data scientists, the first thing they often do is kind of take the metadata aside, because they're like, that's too many columns in their table, and they say, well, we're just going to pay attention to these ones because that's what we're going to train on. And I keep pointing them back going, the other columns are relevant, you organizing your data and understanding contextually what are you actually training on and selecting the subset that you're actually going to work with. Dynamically assessing that quality of the data based on the context. Like I said, it's not just garbage in and garbage out. Not all things that one person may consider garbage may be garbage to another person. It really depends on what question you're asking and how much noise you're willing to take, how much uncertainty you can tolerate in your data set as you build out your models. The provenance piece is really important, knowing where that data has come from, transformations that have taken, assumptions that have been made. And the reason why that's important is, especially in AI models, we need to understand what data was actually utilized, and looking at all of the context and metadata around the data that's been utilized as you train that data, because there's going to be further and further assumptions that get embedded. And this is true even for LLMs. So one of the things that people are, it's great that it can actually take in unstructured data, but is that really going to eliminate some of these pieces of practice bias, for instance? So if a patient population, just because we have representation of the entire sort of representative population of the US, does that really eliminate bias out of that model? Or does it possibly reinforce biased practices that have been in place for a long time, because it's going to learn that certain subpopulations of patients get certain treatments and see these outcomes, and that becomes embedded into that model. And so how do we undo that? How do we actually insert a way to correct for that, to actually improve care for the overall population and not widen the gap, but narrow that gap? And so these are nuances if we don't talk about the context, we will start to overlook. And when it comes to the EHR data, I'm sure many of you appreciate that everyone celebrates this exponential explosion of data, and yet all of us are probably overwhelmed with the explosion of data. And the piece is there is that if you're trying to create decision support tools just using the EHR data, I think all of you who have picked up a phone and talked to a colleague know that we don't go back and run and document that conversation that has led to that decision. And so if the data scientists that have access to the EHR are finding associations between these parameters and this treatment decision, is that really these parameters that led to this treatment decision, or was it the 5 other conversations that you've had with the patient and family because of, you know, social situations, with your colleagues because you're saying something doesn't seem right? And so I think that we need to inform our data scientists to say, you know, these things aren't complete. The EHR is not a complete record of all of the decision making that led to that treatment decision. And so that gap needs to get narrowed. And that's one of the things that we wanted to instill in the Institute for Data Science, is bringing the data scientists and clinicians closer together. You start to have this conversation saying, do you know that this is not actually the whole story? Because I think the concept of digital medicine, they think everything is in there, similar to the fact that they think because machines took the images must be quantitative and they must all be uniform, which is completely untrue. And there are many computer vision data scientists that I've talked to, when I actually tell them how heterogeneous it is, they look at you thinking, I had no clue that was happening. So it's just an interesting point. Now, we're all celebrating multimodal models, and I think that there's a lot of excitement in layering in computer vision with genomics, with the clinical data. But the one piece that we need to heed and pay attention to, and there's a whole area of science and statistics that I think we need to start to consider, is how do we integrate these multiple sources while including the spatial and temporal uncertainties in the inferences? So each of these data sources have their own source of uncertainty, and each of these data sources as they get put into the model are being put in with certain assumptions. And so how do we start to model out the complex, the composite uncertainty in the actual output of those models when it gets to multimodal is something that a lot of the mathematicians and modelers are actually starting to work through. And I think that from a clinical standpoint, we need to help them understand what do we need as outputs to help us make that decision? Because ultimately, it's not a decision support tool if you get nebulous answers out and you can't really use this to help you make a decision. So how do you present that uncertainty to help clinicians and patients make a good decision? The way that I've approached this in terms of working with data scientists is that I think that, you know, there's the publication and then there's implementation. There's usually a giant chasm in the middle. So how do we actually do that? We need to start thinking about it from the start. As you're designing the model, as you're working with someone who's designing the model, really pay attention to what is the problem that you're trying to answer, because that is what's going to dictate what data you actually need. A lot of data scientists start up here. They say, well, what data is available? And they say, I have enough data, it's all complete. I'm going to work on it to clean it up, and I'm going to develop a model. But that's not really going to help us develop models that are really successfully translated. I think we need to start with, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? And what kind of model training and validation do we need? What metrics do we actually need to convince ourselves that we would actually use this? And then go back to say, do we even have the data consistently to do this? When we think about model implementation, we have to think back to the stakeholder and operational readiness. And this is where a lot of models are being inserted into the current workflow, and it's just adding another step, adding an alarm, adding a distraction, or adding another data input that's overwhelming the system. We have to think about, how do we pivot? If this is important enough that we can actually develop a model and we have the data, how do we actually pivot the operational model and the workflow so that it's additive and not an, it's additive in a constructive way, not additive in a distracting or overwhelming way? Understanding the model outputs by all stakeholders. So how do we actually present the outputs of these models? Right now, a lot of the, especially the LLMs, give you very confident responses that are very nicely phrased. I think some people are getting irritated with just how nicely phrased they are, because when you actually take a step back and read through the words, they can sound a lot like jargon. But at the same time, I think that we need to think about, how do we present the information with the underlying uncertainty? There is work that has been done in terms of traceability, so you can often hover over and see where that's come from. But how realistic is that they're expecting all of us to go back and now hover over all of these other areas and documents, and perhaps even entire transcripts? I don't think that that is going to be a true time savings in the long run. Having said that, if that's not the solution, then how do we present the uncertainty to the clinicians so that they're aware, so they can make a good decision moving forward? Finally, in terms of the evolving human-AI interactions, we actually have ongoing research here around trust and confidence. There are people who have human bias, want to trust themselves and ignore the AI. There are ongoing discussions around, what does that mean from a legal perspective? If you've gotten the information and you've ignored it, are you legally liable? Vice versa, there's automation bias, especially with visual and some subconscious tasks. I think most of you may have heard about the New England Journal paper around gastroenterologists doing scopes. And basically, within weeks, they had lost their visual skills. I don't think they've lost their visual skills. I think they've lost the attention because they've become reliant and subconsciously reliant on little red boxes showing up of where they're supposed to look. But I think we really need to start to think about, what does that mean in how we train? We've started conversations with the airline industry of how do you keep pilots trained up? If they're going to use autopilot on a regular basis, how do you train them to know when to overtake the plane and not allow autopilot to do what it's doing. It started making me think that maybe the increasing number of airplane events was because of autopilot and pilots not maintaining their training. But it's something that we need to think about, of how do we actually maintain skills? Everyone's talking about upskilling our workforce to be able to use AI. The vice versa is, how do we make sure we keep our clinical skills strong enough that we're an effective, enabled human in the loop, is something that we need to figure out as a community overall. And so that goes to the training piece. The final piece is that this whole cyborg psychology, the way that we interact with these devices is slowly changing our own way of our attention span, how we're thinking. It can influence sort of how you may approach situations. And so I think that there's a whole field of science that needs to happen in terms of starting to understand how this is. Now, I think the influence is happening faster than the science can keep up with it, but I think that we need to be cognizant of this. So, you know, in cancer, I would say that AI is great promise. I think one of the things that we need to do is that often AI has been used as in a reductive way to make things simpler. I think that hopefully I've given you examples of where we actually need to embrace the complexity, look at the metadata, look at the context, because it'll actually help us deepen our understanding as well as help us make those decisions in a more meaningful way, balancing the fact that medicine has always been a science of uncertainty and an art of probability. And I think that, you know, AI in medicine really represents a lot of that. We do need to think about context from design all the way through to delivery, and design while we're thinking about how we're actually going to deliver. And we do need to think about, how do we inform that tolerable uncertainty in the clinical practice? There are certain places where we have clear equipoise and we're willing to enroll patients on trials to two different arms of therapy. So where is that equipoise when we think about how we're actually going to use these tools? And should we be building tools out where we're really definitively very confident, or should we be working in other areas? Because there's a huge breadth of where we could actually be applying this technology. So I'll wrap up there and happy to take questions. Yes?
Great presentation. I really love the part where you said, where you mentioned about data completeness gap. The data scientists build models assuming that everything resides in the EMR system, whereas in reality it doesn't. So what are some of the strategies that you've seen work to integrate the non-EMR data, for example, claims data or utilization management data, telematics data that sits in the, say, siloed vendor system into the AI models without overwhelming operations?
Yeah, so we've actually, so the way that we've tackled that at MD Anderson is that when I took on the role as CDO, we actually said, we're not going to have research data sitting over here, clinical data sitting over there, operations data sitting here. We actually wanted to bring that into one place. So we call our data management system Context Engine, and we actually intentionally brought the operational data closer to the clinical data, as well as not creating separate research silos, because the translation of research models into the clinic become very difficult when you have these two silos. So bringing that together and then having filtered views based on whatever your role is at the institution. So if you're looking at it from an operations lens, you obviously can see all the operational plus relevant clinical pieces. If you're looking at it from a clinical perspective, you get access to the clinical data. Other than the break the glass. And then if you're looking at from research, then we got the governance around, you know, do you have an IRB? Are you part of the study, et cetera? And doing that has helped us start to ask cross-functional questions, like what are the financial implications, and as well as sort of how do you actually navigate access? So we've been able to ask access questions as research and quality improvement questions.
Which architecture to employ at a given time. I know it's 3D XNet, and you could easily use 3D Vision Net and bring you right now.
That's a good question. I can't say that I know. I can't say you're saying how do I know? I can tell you that I don't know. So I think there are certain learnings that we have taken in terms of the size and complexity of the shape, for instance, with vision models specifically, the size and complexity of the shape of something can actually help you figure out which architecture would likely work versus not. And then the other piece is that how noisy is the background? And so this goes back to the quality question. So I think that ironically, you can take a UNet or a DenseNet that works perfectly well, and then you start to insert data that's more noisy. And some are more sensitive to having that noise. And so we've actually done sort of robustness tests to help learn if there are clear patterns of what will work better versus not. But I don't think there's still a lot of research to be done in that space, because people are not yet looking at quality to performance of model in a direct way.
My follow-up question on that is, why not employ something like GradCam visualization in order to kind of try and get a peek into the black box and understand what's going on?
You can do that, yeah. But again, in those circumstances, I have not seen papers written specifically looking at what is the impact of image quality in even with those models. Yeah. And I think that's an opportunity for a paper, right? So, yeah. Yes.
First of all, it's amazing talk. I'm Jim Wakeful from Phoenix, Arizona. Thinking more around your comment around the data that's missing, how powerful that is. And while I thought initially about, as we roll out Ambient, right, we're starting to collect a lot of data that we didn't used to. But yet, in our organization, I'm an internal medicine physician, we use sort of secure texting solutions. And one of the things that was most important to the physicians was that we didn't archive the information, because they wanted to be able to have authentic, honest conversations without the risk of worrying about liability. And that just tells you that the missing information may be the most important information it really.
Yes.
Another example of a really insightful comment.
It's so difficult, because the fear of litigation and medical liability, even with Ambient, I think that people are concerned that the conversation's changing, right? So you know that something is taking your transcript. Now, the other thing is that those transcripts are also, most companies will only hold it for 30 days and they'll delete it. So that we've actually started to look at whether, at least in a subset for research purposes, because we wanted to see, does that transcript, to your point, does that secure chat, does that transcript from the Ambient listing really bring other insights out that we're losing? Because when we actually talk about what's in the clinical note, and everyone talks about the clinical note being raw data, it isn't raw data. It's the physician or clinician nurse's inference of what's important and medically relevant that gets documented in the chart. You know, an example is, you ask a patient, how did you get here? And you ask them an open-ended question like that. They often say, I was on a plane and I was going from here to there, and they're telling you this whole story. What happens if the last 20 patients that you saw all started their story that way? That could be a really relevant detail of why was that happening? Why did it happen to all these patients? But we lose that, because that's not necessarily documented. People don't think that's medically relevant. So they go back to, 46-year-old, whatever, presents with pain, and they're talking about the actual pieces you think are medically relevant, and you're losing all the context around possible etiological signals. So it's really challenging to know how to handle the regulatory legal situation versus the data that we could potentially be throwing away in just because of fear. So.
How realistic, or how much hope do you have that for things like the variance in data from different sources, and even reproducibility of data from an individual institution. How much do you think we're going to be able to, through policy or something like that, get vendors to manage to make it much more consistent throughout the country? If that is realistic, how would we even go about trying to get that done?
Yeah, so I think one of the pieces here is that everyone's still paying attention to the text information in the EHR. But there was a really interesting article, I'll have to dig it up and I'll get it to you, is saying how language is a really bad medium for communicating information. Because no matter how much you standardize the structure, you may get syntactic, you could enforce syntactic interoperability, right? So you could actually, because you can QA, you can say it doesn't work. You can force that on the vendors, but we can't unless we can actually somehow figure out extracting the semantic meaning out of these text words. And there's, you know, great sentences that people have used to give an example of, depending on how you emphasize a different word out of a short sentence, you know, no, I did not do that, or, you know, I didn't do that, or, you know, I didn't do that. Those things mean something different. All of you in the room know that that means something different if I say it that way. But we don't have a way of capturing that in text. And so even if you have the entire sentence, unless you have the intonation and how the person has said it, you're not going to necessarily pull out the semantics. And so there is this whole, how do we actually capture that data better than necessarily language? Because we've really, you know, boiled it down to text, and we're constantly scraping through text. And I think that, you know, with all of the different wearables and ways that we are capturing information, I think at some point we will get there. So I don't think it's going to be in the near future, but I think we're going to have to go past language and really go multimodal to get all of that information. Having said that, the US CDI Plus, just to give you a bit of heads up, the US CDI Plus is something that the NIH, FDA, HHS, and ONC are really collaborating on to try to get rolled out. They've been developing tools to actually help auto pull and auto harmonize certain data elements out of the EHRs. And I think they're definitely working with Epic. I don't know if they're working with all the vendors at this point in time, but they're working towards that approach. And so that will help with certain data elements, for instance, like SEER data, certain priority SEER data elements. They're trying to minimize the delay, this 3-year delay of getting SEER data out, for example. So I think that there's baby steps towards going in that direction. But I think, like I said, the semantic meaning is really difficult to actually get out of any sort of text, written text. Okay, thank you.